Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Behind the Badge, Illinois. We're talking technology today. Technology, there are two different ways. We're going to be diving deeper into technology. When you think of technology, you might be thinking of radar, walkie-talkies, communications, drones. So we're going to dive deep into the different technologies that police officers use throughout the state of Illinois and the United States that keep us safe, keeps the public safe. There's two different types that the public might not know about. They're broken down into what's called hard technologies and soft technologies. And I've got my notes here so I don't mess this up. So excuse my eyes from wandering. Hard technologies are tangible resources to permit crime and are distinguished by innovations in material, devices, and equipment such as less than lethal weaponry, mobile computers, drones, surveillance cameras, and the all-important body armor equipment to keep our police officers safe. And then there's soft technologies, which strategically use information to prevent crime and are distinguished by new computer programs, analysis techniques, and methods of data sharing or system integration, such as predictive software, mapping, and facial recognition software. And we'll also talk about another one. I learned during my police academy, Citizens Police Academy, that there's something called a police, a license plate reader now as well, which I found fascinating as a resident of my town, that at stoplights, the police were able to scan license plates and communicate bad things going on and people stealing cars or using different cars to do bad things. And they're able to track license plates, which I thought was pretty cool. So let's start it. Ladies first, we'll go to Mimi talking about your topic, I think, is what, Mimi? I can't read my notes here. Radios.
Yep.
Go ahead, my friend.
Walkie-talkies.
Because you walkie and you talkie. I mean, that's
great. All right, so I'm just going to read a little brief history of the radio. So before police radio systems were first implemented, police officers assigned to their beat could only communicate with police command using telephone booths, call boxes, police boxes, or physical meetings. Calling for help or signaling other officers could only be done by shouting, using a whistle, or hitting things to make sounds. This meant that properly calling for assistance, reporting an incident or arrest, being dispatched to handle a crime, or requesting police resources was only possible if the officer reached a telephone or a call box. The first police radio systems were implemented in Detroit in 1928. When the Detroit Police Department set up a one-way radio system to broadcast crime information to police cars. The first two-way police radio system was implemented by the Bayonne, New Jersey Police in 1933. Due to their cost and size, early police radio systems were only used in police cars and buildings. Officers on foot patrols still had to rely on telephones and call boxes. Portable radios introduced in the 1960s made radio communications widely accessible to all officers. Early portable radios were heavy and had short battery life, an issue that gradually disappeared as technology advanced. Modern police radio systems are often augmented by mobile data terminals, which we call MDTs, to effectively manage units and assignments.
So when you guys are first brought out of the academy, what type of training are you given in the academy about these type of devices that the officers are going to be using in the field? Is there a class on it, or is it just like, all right, get in the car and we're going to show you how everything works? I mean, how does that, how do you train cadets coming up and going through the academy?
So in the academy, you're introduced to the radio probably, I would say, maybe midway through, and you're given a class. So you're taught from the very beginning, like the overall use of the radio, 10 codes. We all know what our 10 codes are. And gradually, as you go through the academy, they're incorporating it more and more into each phase that you're going through the academy. So you go from, you know, learning about it, then you go from listening to it, maybe listening to some of the radio traffic that's going on in that troop. And then finally, at the end, you're really incorporating using the radio on actual, mock traffic stops and mock incidents, and you're getting to use the radio. Now, one of the things, and then obviously you graduate and you come out to the field. One of the things I can remember really early on in my career, when I first got to the district, so we have our radios, they told us, keep your radio on all day long at home and just listen to it. Listen to just what the verbiage is, and so that's what I would do. I would, whatever, be around the house. And if I was in the house, I'd throw my radio on just so I can hear and get used to the lingo that everyone was talking, because you do get very used to that by just hearing it. But to answer your question, we were trained in it. I mean, you have to know how to use your radio, and that becomes your best friend on the job. That's your lifeline, is your radio.
Do you guys, and I'll throw it around to the other panel, do you guys use the same type of radios? Does each municipality have their own different brand? Do they sync up through the technology so you can communicate with each other? How do you, in DeKalb, O'Fallon, and Highland Park, what's the your procedures for ordering, buying, and maintaining each of your equipments? I'll start with Bird up in Chief Bird up in DeKalb.
So for years, Motorola had basically had cornered the market with police radios, and I have some old radios I would like to show just everyone who's watching. But these are the size. I mean, this is like a brick. I mean, we used to call these bricks because they felt like a brick. If you can see him holding it, I mean, Dave, you can see how big it is. I mean, the antenna is not even in the picture. So now, and also think, when you compare it to what I'm wearing now, I mean, I have the lapel microphone, which we didn't have back then. When, you had to actually, most people spoke on these radios just in their hand. They didn't have the extended mic early on, especially in the 80s. And I came on in 89. So, a lot of this stuff wasn't prevalent. Most of my guys now, I just came from downstairs. They have the earpiece. So all those type of things, that just tells you the evolution of the radio. And if you look at the two radios together, and now this is the one I'm issued now. And if you look at this one, I mean, you can see the difference. I mean, these things were just huge. I have an older one that probably was used in the early 70s, also made by Motorola, and it actually has walkie-talkie FM radio put on here. And it's amazing how, and this came with a repeater system, not to get too technical, but with ISP, we had a repeater system where we could actually hear. We had to turn, like you make a traffic stop, you had to turn the nozzle on the interior radio so you could hear the actual radio traffic outside the car. And it came out of a speaker outside of the vehicle. So you depended on that. You could hear everybody talking from a speaker that was being with pushing all the radio traffic outside of the vehicle. So those were some of the early uses of the police radios. It's amazing how far we have evolved. Like I said, with the size of these radios that we're using now, I think they have emergency buttons on these radios. These older radios did not have emergency buttons. So if you got in an emergency, if you could not get on the radio and call for an assistance, you were in a fight. If this you lost this, I mean, you're pretty much on your own if it got tossed in a fight. Now we have emergency buttons on here, very small buttons. You can't is embedded into the mic and also embedded to the radio. So if you get into a fight and you need assistance, you can press this button, Dave. And it'll give you priority over the channel. So you get to take. So if you were talking and I press this button, it's going to wipe you out and it's going to give me priority. So I can, so the person who is involved in the situation can have priority and talk to everybody and they can hear what's going on. So a lot of The evolution of the radio is unbelievable. Motorola, like I said, had cornered the market on this for years. There are some other, manufacturers now that, like this radio actually isn't even Motorola. This is a Kenwood radio. So, I mean, there are other manufacturers out there. So, I mean, but it's amazing how everything has evolved. So,
Burke or Lou, you want to add anything?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, I'm sure there's debate, and yes, different law enforcement personnel, what the most significant piece of equipment they carry. But to Mimi's point, this is your lifeline, this radio. I mean, I started and I had the luxury of having radios, but my dad was a police officer and folks that went before us. I mean, I can't imagine either not having a radio and just being out there, right? And if you need help, I mean, you're out there. Or even when the radios then were in the squad car, once you left the squad car and you went into a bar fight or you went looking for somebody, you're on your own. I mean, you're absolutely on your own. Nobody knows where you're at. I mean, that is a different way of policing. So necessity is the mother of invention. And over years, as Dave just showed everybody how the radios have evolved and continue to evolve, I think it absolutely increases public safety. Absolutely increases officer safety. It is your lifeline. And to your point, Dave Hochberg, interoperability is a huge thing. Clearly, 9/11, 2001, that was one of the takeaways, that the interoperability was a challenge for first responders. And so since then, there's been a heavy, heavy emphasis on trying to connect and make these systems interoperable. So yeah, the radios we carry in Highland Park, we certainly are linked with all of our neighboring towns. We share a dispatch center, so we have four towns on our dispatch, primary dispatch. So we're listening to the traffic of four other towns or three other towns with us. But we can connect by turning buttons with the state police, with a statewide network. We have like dozens of channels on there now that are interoperable with other agencies throughout the state. So that's incredible when you have an incident like July 4th. I mean, we actually put everybody on the same channel. We could talk. Imagine years ago not being able to do that. And so very, very fortunate. And it's interesting. And, people, when they're talking to a police officer, you can pay attention to this. It's an odd thing. You know your radio number, your call number. Your ear is attuned to it as a police officer. As Mimi said, you get trained to it. But, we talk to people. We have conversations. You may see an officer then for a second, oh, hold on. And they hear something on the radio because you're just one ear is on that. One ear is on the person. And people who clearly are trained or in the business aren't really knowing what's going on that radio. But we can hear tenor of voice. If somebody's like, if there's a call that might be starting to go a little bit sideways, you could hear it in the voice of your officers. You know who the officer is by their voice. So it's a really unique tool. But absolutely, from my perspective, definitely one of the more important tools that our officers carry.
Kirk, down in O'Fallon, how many different forces are you tied into down there? I mean, you got larger geographical area down there, right? So are you tied into three? I shouldn't say larger. It's not as densely populated as like a Highland Park or maybe Highwood that Lou's tied into, or Northbrook or Glenview, which are all by him. How do you work down south?
Yeah, very similar. Radio networks, throughout our area are all interconnected. It's important to know though too that when I get in my car and I drive up to Highland Park for a meeting, my radio doesn't really work anymore. Without doing some other things, my radio's tied into the network down here with some interoperability up there for some certain channels. But for the most part, when I drive an hour away from our radio network in the southern part of the state, I'm not able to necessarily contact them on the radio. So it's not necessarily like a cell phone network where I can get on my radio in New York and talk to somebody in O'Fallon. So there are some limitations to it, but they are pretty fantastic. Like he mentioned these radios. A lot of people don't know this, but this right here is like $5,000 right here. That everybody, this radio cost us like $5,000 to have. And so when I left it at Cyberg's, one of our restaurants one day, after that was not a good thing. and the waitress hit the little orange button, the emergency button, just seeing what it was, probably not the best thing to happen, but
did it work? I mean,
yeah, it worked. All right. On my way back. So, yeah,
the phone.
And to what Lou said too, is like our telecommunicators are on the other end of that. You know, they're the ones that are answering those phones and making sure that we're safe. And they, without a doubt, can tell tone and inflection in some in an officer's voice when something might not be right. So it is a crazy awesome thing that we get to learn. You mentioned too about 10 codes. You know, do we learn all the 10 codes? That was real big when I started. You had a list of all the 10 codes, and most everybody used somewhat similar 10 codes around the country with a few changes. But like what Lou said with 9/11 and interoperability. They've really kind of, you know, we still use some 10 codes, but they really don't want you to use 10 codes on the air. They would rather you use plain English, because if something's happening and Highland Park has a different 10 code than we have, and we're talking, it may mean something totally different. Where a 1032 for us might mean a person with a gun. It might mean a meal break for somebody else. Maybe not that, but, you know... So
every code is a meal break for us. That's
We try to always use plain. There was we want our officers to use plain English when they're talking things, and you want to keep it short and sweet. We all know that officer that gets on there and reads from the Iliad and the Odyssey as he's talking on the radio, because when they're on the radio, nobody else can talk. So.
Well, you started, Mimi. Do you want to end it with the story when you were a colonel with the Illinois State Police? Hang on, your mic
muted, Pete.
Okay, so yeah, so thank you. So yeah, so just really quick, I think one of the things you had asked, Dave, was the communications with other departments. And I can remember when we first got on, Dave, you remember this. We used to, the thing when we came to Chicago was we had to get a Chicago radio. Like we had to get a radio that had all the channels that Chicago PD had so that we can communicate with them. So that's what we did. We all went out and bought our own little radio and then had it programmed so that we can communicate with Chicago PD. Now what they've done is they've incorporated some of those bands into the radios that we currently have. So I think the communication with other police departments have gotten really a lot better than when we first came on. Obviously there's still ISBN. That's the emergency broadcast that anyone in that, you know, I'm not sure what the mile radius is, but it goes pretty far. You can hear ISBNs from county to county. And we're able to communicate via one channel. And, you know, I do know like most police departments have that, if not all, where they're able to communicate with, you know, to put out a broadcast so that everybody can hear. So I do think we've made great strides in communicating with each other. Because I'll tell you what, when we have an incident and there's, you know, we have several people on here that have gone through big incidents, communication is everything. If you don't have the communication, you're stuck. You're stuck. It's very frustrating when you can't communicate. So, you know, the radios to communicate with each other, to get the extra resources and assistance is paramount.
Permission, Fred. Dave,
yeah, go ahead.
We got an acronym thrown in there, so I want to see if we can. I'm not sure I know this one, so I'm hoping my two state police folks do. So ISBN was mentioned. That's a statewide radio network managed by the state police. Dave, Mimi, tell me if I'm right. Does that stand for Illinois State Police Emergency Radio Network?
Network, yep.
Yes, right. That's.
You got it.
So that's ISBN. Okay, so that's a statewide network. That was an early way for us to communicate well before 9/11, but that was one way that you can hear what's going on throughout the state. You can get on there for only limited reasons, but right. So ISBN. All right.
Yeah, and you had to meet a certain criteria for, you know, to dispatch on ISBN, and they would tell you if you didn't meet it, the dispatcher would jump on and say, hey, have your department call our department directly. Yep. That's not, you know, and then of course pursuits you could use on ISBN for sure. Very successful because you're crossing across, you know, different county lines and jurisdictions. So ISBN was great for that. And then, you know, it's funny, you know, I know Kirk mentioned 10 codes. We still use them here in DeKalb. Guys, we use them a lot. ISP used to use them strictly, and then they went to common language. after, and then it's really more of a hodgepodge. ISB did go away from it, but a lot of troopers still use it. And one of the biggest, if you go to Chicago, see a 10-1 is emergency assistance, CPD. If they call out a 10-1, that means everybody's gone. Here, in most terms, 10-1 is just a weak signal. We just can't hear you. So in most other jurisdictions, but with CPD, a 10-1 means everybody go. Everybody go. And it's amazing how, like Kirk mentioned, it's so different. But here in DeKalb, like I said, overall, we still use a lot of 10 codes. It was a little bit of a weird transition for me when I got here 3 years ago, because I went from 10 codes, common language, 10 codes. So I'm like, oh, shoot, we're going back. So it's interesting, but you just learn to adapt and in Rome, you do as the Romans do. So it's all good. But, it's 10 codes is one of those things you just don't forget most of it. Most of you remember it's like your alphabet. If you've done it for a long period of time, you just continue to remember those things, which is, that's a way of communicating. That's all it is, but either one works, which is great.
Here's a question for you. Is any of your departments carrying CB radios in their cars anymore? We carried them when I first started, but not anymore.
Oh, man. Well, ISP, we had them. Every car had a CB. When I first started, every car, because when you talk about cars, I started my first car was a 1985 Diplomat, Dodge Diplomat. That was my first squad car. And it had a CB radio in there, a scanner. It had the whip antenna. So if you guys remember the old school state cruisers had the whip, you had that on there. It was amazing and I thought that was the best car I had ever seen, that old Dodge Dip. But man, and then just to see the evolution of the squad. I mean, it was like, that car, you hit a bump and you get all this shake every time. It was like ridiculous. Trying to keep it in the lane was almost impossible. So then I went from an 85 Dodge Dip to a 87 Chevy Caprice, the boxed out Chevy, which I love that car, man. It was prototypical state police cruiser was that box Chevy Caprice with the whip antenna. So, we had the CBs though, Kirk. The cars down here now, they don't have them. I bet you I couldn't find one.
Dave, what was your handle? I know you're a CB enthusiast.
No, Dave, I'm very good. Dave, what you have?
Dave Hochberg's the CB enthusiast.
Yeah, it was Love Train, but that was just because I love trains. That's why. So it was easier just to break 19 Love Train. Are you out there? So that's, and I'd usually buy, you'd be by a train crossing, okay, Waiting for the trains to cross, because that's the way I rolled when I was younger. So
truckers used to call the troopers all the time on the CBs, like Kirk. I'm telling you guys that they were, hey, Smokey, you got your ears on all the time. We jump on there and they would give us some good information. They helped out a lot. So you actually had, in certain areas, having your CB on, especially in the rural areas, was impactful for the troopers. In the city, maybe not so much, but in those rural areas, for sure.
You ever hear Love Train on there?
I never heard Love Train. Dave, were you?
Well, I try to stay away from those box cars with the whip antennas.
There's a song called Love Train, so I don't know.
I know.
Might have to learn that, Dave.
No problem. Well, when I go back to driving 18-wheelers over the road, I'll let you guys know so you could, we can stay in touch. I just wanted to point out one thing for everybody listening. Why did that might not be aware of this, but back in the 80s, I know we covered this on a previous podcast. Back in the 80s is when ISP took over patrolling the Chicago roadways, the Edens, the Kennedy, the 290, I-55 into the city, and might be weird for some listeners listening now, but going back into the 80s when you guys took over, when ISP took over, it was a trade. That's why you needed to upgrade your equipment. I just thought I'd throw that out there. All right, let's throw it over to
1986. Yep.
1986, yeah. So let's throw it over to Lou. Let's talk about radar. Every person that drives fast, perfect piece of equipment that the police have. So the evolution of radar.
It is an important piece of equipment. There's no doubt about it. And I'm sure there are many listeners out there that have been acquainted with it on one end or the other. But a little history of the radar gun and how it came into being. Always find this stuff interesting. You know, actually, the radar gun was developed by an aircraft company because they were trying to figure out a design flaw. So the Grundon Aircraft Corporation was developing amphibious aircraft in World War II. Those aircraft would end up landing on water and landing. When they landed on a runway, they had some damage happening to landing gear because they couldn't really measure where the landing gear were. So they wanted to come up with a way to have something to measure, some system to measure the land coming up. So a man named John Barker Sr. and Ben Midlock were two men who developed for the military. They started with a Doppler radar unit from coffee cans, soldered shot to make a microwave resonators inside, I guess, at the end of the runway, pointed upwards. So it sent out beams and it worked. So after the war, you know, they kind of played with it a little more. And the first radar was used by police in 1947. You know, the first one used by Connecticut State Police for traffic surveys, just to kind of see what speeds were going on. And then the New York State Police started using them in 48. And in 1949, that's when it all started for all of us. They started issuing tickets based on the radar. It became technology that was supported and proven technology, and we use it. And the units have changed over the years, size-wise and otherwise, but the technology is still the same. It shoots out a beam, and the beam bounces back off the car that's moving, and it's able to calibrate that speed of the car and show that to the officer instead of just an officer looking visual. You know, you can confirm. You do this job long enough, you can look at a car. Basically, you run radar long enough, and I'm sure my state trooper friends will acknowledge this as well. And you could go, yeah, that car's doing 36. You know, you can tell for sure because you've done that radar unit so long. But, you know, we use the radar clearly to enforce speed. We enforce speed because we want to keep people safe. So it is an interesting piece of equipment. It's evolved over the years size-wise, not really the technology. However, there's another piece, and we can kind of talk about this after the other folks go around, but it's called a LIDAR. And that is the newer evolution technology that shoots a laser beam. And, you know, the state police may use it a little bit more. It's got more distance and it's a little more precise because it aims this laser beam and then bounces back. In an urban setting, it could be useful because you could pinpoint a car. But that's it. That's kind of what radar is. And you know, again, you'll see every police car is equipped with one, and we use them again for speed checks primarily. But we also use them for data analysis. We'll put there are radar units that you can put in a box on the side of the road and just kind of collect that speed to get an idea. You're not issuing tickets based off of it, but you're getting that speed data so you can determine if that's an area you might want to do some enforcement.
Hey, Kirk, if our listeners are thinking about driving through O'Fallon, where should they be cautious of specifically for speed traps?
Pierce Road.
Wait, David called a speed trap. I mean, that insinuates something David, is there some insinuation you're making? A trap? Are we setting traps? Is that what we do as long
as I'm just trying to be helpful for our listeners. I'm just trying to keep $125 in their pocket instead of the town.
164. 164 is what a speeding ticket is in our county. I think that's probably statewide, isn't it?
$164. I haven't got one in a long time.
Yeah, come through Highland Park, Dave. The way you've been talking, you might find yourself with
36 and a 35.
Yeah,
34 and a 35. 34 to get you because I'm special. We've been out for Love Train. Well, here, I'll throw it out there. What's the fastest that each of you have tracked with the speed gun? You know, go around the horn. Mimi, you start us off.
135.
135 miles an hour.
Yeah. Wow. And I-57 on midnights. Oh, yeah, midnights were crazy. You couldn't keep up with the traffic on midnights on the Ryan and 57.
So what did you do? I mean, you gunned the person at 135. Did you just let him go, or did you call ahead to get?
Tried to catch up with them, and one of them actually I caught up, and then it turns into ag speeding and, you know, misdemeanor. So yeah, midnight. It was very, very, very common to go very, very fast.
The Autobahn. How about you, Kirk? What would your fastest you take?
Not anywhere close to that. We have an interstate goes through town, but our general rule is that we don't go out and patrol the interstate. We keep our officers in town. So, you know, probably in the 90s, if I can remember back when it was, maybe on a, you know, on a normal road, but nothing too crazy.
Dave, you actually have a gun, right? You prepared for show and tell today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is an old Falcon Radar 3 radar. We used these back in the day. These are, of course, a little older than, you know, what we use now, of course, with the moving radars that we have now for front end. So front radar and back. You know, a lot of our traffic team here in DeKalb uses the moving radars. Of course, ISP has been using those for years. But this is what it looks like. This is just an old school radar, but these things were like gold. You know, when I came on the job, you know, you talk about high speeds and, you know, some of the motorcycles would come through in the high, 145s, you know, hauling. And you know, you would, you know, and you're talking about, you know, trying to catch a motorcycle at that speed and you know, in the city, it worked. The only thing that worked out for you is that they ran into some traffic jams. So, you know, you got pockets of traffic. But on a straight line interstate, you ain't going to catch them. You know, the only thing faster than that.
Yeah.
So you got to get on the Rover. You get on the Rover here, and then if you get on that Rover and you call ahead, you could probably get them. Sometimes we would just track. And I will say this about motorcycles and you're talking about speed detection. One of the biggest impacts we had was air operations. So when we started, ISP had helicopter for a pretty good while. Of course, there's a CPD in Cook County have a helicopter right now, and you can really benefit from air ops. They were impactful for us. So we wouldn't, even with our fixed wing aircraft as well, we would run radar, you know, of course, with the fixed wing aircraft. And they could track these motorcycles for us. So that changed the game a lot for us. You know, at the end of the day, we wouldn't have to do 100 something miles an hour trying to catch them, which was dangerous for the officers. I mean, you know, and for the public, for us to be trying to get through traffic at that speed. When you got air ops following them, all you got to do is, you know, listen to the radio. They got spotters in the helicopter. They will tell you exactly where they are, and they'll tell you where you can pick them up at. So so a lot of times that was something that we didn't always have. But when the helicopter and air operations was put into effect, it was a game changer for law enforcement.
Would they shoot a beam down on them to track how fast they were going, or did they time them from distance to distance?
I can tell you that
experience.
Who got caught by one?
Yeah, I got caught. I can tell you right now. I don't even have to be in the plane. No, they have a painted stripe on the ground, a stripe on the expressway, and then a certain distance later, another stripe, and they've determined the distance, and they're able to calculate your speed by the time you start crossing that first stripe to the second stripe, and then they're able to call down to their ground units, which I learned, that they then pull you over for speeding, and they're pretty precise on the speed. They either use a stopwatch or however they compute it, but they can calculate your speed based on the distance and how fast you cross that distance. And I can tell you the court supported it because I went to court and paid my fine.
Yeah, the odds of you beating an air, air ticket like that, yeah, you might as well forget about it.
Yeah, I didn't try.
They get you down. When they tell you your speed is like, oh, he was doing 95.6782, forget about it. You got no shot, so.
For the record, I wasn't going anywhere near 95, but I definitely wasn't going, I wasn't going 55. So that's all I will say on the record.
So while we're on the subject, so that was one of the first things I did in my rookie year was go up in the plane. It was my first and last time in the plane because it was, just you're riding around in circles, but it was really cool to see how it all worked and to call them out and to see where they're positioned. It was actually pretty cool. So that was
you were spotted in, right?
Spotter. Yeah. Yeah.
So how did it work?
And then he had to go to court.
Spotter. Did you have a stopwatch like Lou was saying? I mean, how did that work?
You literally will just exactly what Lou said. As soon as they hit the white strip on the roadway, you hit your stopwatch, and then once they clear it, you hit it again, and you literally will put down how long it took them to get from A to B, and then you calculate. Like, there's something we calculate the speed and what the speed limit is. So very, very cool. It was cool to be up there.
Yeah, Dave, and then you got ten rows of troopers, and then you call them out, and then they go. Next guy's up, he goes. Next guy up, he goes, and then that's how you run them down. And like I said, most people who go into court who got a ticket from an airspeed detail, they don't even contest it because they know they're not going to win that. So
two things, Dave, real quick before we move on to the next one. I know you're going to move on to it, but I think it's important for our listeners to know. Again, we do this because we just want to slow people down, keep people safe. So to the credit of the state police, they would put signs up that say air patrol with a picture of a plane. They will tell you, they will warn you, I did not listen. And then secondly, just as kind of further evidence of that, of our interest in really just preventing people from speeding, I'm sure a lot of people will see on their phones now as they're driving technology on your MapQuest, or not MapQuest, boy, I'm dating myself, but on your Google, your Apple phones, they'll tell you speed check ahead, when you're on your map. And we're okay with that. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, team, but we want speed check ahead. They're warning people, people would think that we'd rather catch you, to Dave Hochberg's point, a trap. No, not a trap. We are okay with them putting that out there, because really what we want is people to slow down. And guess what? It works. You get that on your phone, you're going to slow down. So that's actually helping us. So you can look at this radar as a start and where it's taken us. It's really evolved quite a bit.
The number one complaint by far throughout the state when I talk to other chiefs is speeding vehicles.
You got it.
And it has been that way for 25 years. It will probably be that way for the next 25 years.
Until we get autonomous cars that drive and they're mandated to go a certain speed limit, then we'll be okay.
It will be all right, huh? Yeah.
So it is just a never-ending battle to try to get people to slow down. And
yes,
everybody else is speeding but the person that's complaining.
That's right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Everyone's in a hurry.
Everyone's in a hurry to go nowhere, right?
Go nowhere.
Yeah, that's right. And then, and God help, and then even the ones who flee the police, we talked about pursuits, I think, a couple of shows back. But, we got to talk about the technology with stop sticks and, to try to terminate pursuit. So there's some technology there. It wasn't available when I started, but it was a game changer. You have GPS trackers now, Dave, that you can that can be shot from a vehicle onto a vehicle that's fleeing, so you can track them through GPS. So there's some other technology that can enable the car completely, disable the car completely. So there's a lot of technology out there to stop pursuits, because I think we talked about this in another show, how dangerous the pursuits are and to the public. So, of course, in law enforcement, we've been trying to find these different technologies to avoid these type of high-speed pursuits, because they are so dangerous. But, some of this technology is unbelievably expensive, and it's not free. That's what people, I talk to my guys all the time and ask them, hey, what type of technology do you want us to seek out that will help you do your job more effectively? And we get a whole list of ideas and thoughts, but, some of that stuff is just not practical, man. It's some of that stuff is so expensive. But it's stuff out there like that to get these offenders who want to flee law enforcement. So we'll see what happens. But a lot of stuff out there.
All right, let's transition to Kirk talking about body armor, topic that I am near and dear to my heart, because we do the Vestathon here up in Chicago every, I think, February. I think we've raised close to $2 million for the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation to buy replacement vests for officers that can't afford them. The fact that they have to buy a replacement vest in and of itself is ridiculous, but you know, we won't dive deep into that right now. But let's talk about how the body armor has morphed and become more efficient to keep the men and women in law enforcement safe.
Yeah, so the use of body armor actually predates written history. I have seen Game of Thrones, so I know that they use body armor in that show. So I think that's a long time ago. So people have been trying to protect themselves against bullets since the invention of guns. The first recorded attempt at producing a specific bulletproof vest is back in 1538 in Italy. But if we're kind of talking about modern ballistic body armor, you're talking about Kevlar. I think that's what everybody is knows to be body armor. It was first discovered by a research scientist named Stephanie Lewis Kwolek in 1971. I don't know if she knew how many people that she would save when she invented this, but she was working with a liquid crystalline polymer solution that seemed to have some remarkably useful properties. It could be formed into a synthetic fiber, which could in turn be woven and then layered into an incredibly strong fabric. So the new fabric was found to have 5 times the tensile strength of steel. So it was kind of like Superman's hair. The new fabric was, so Kwolek was working for DuPont at the time of her discovery, and she introduced the product as to the world as Kevlar. So it immediately kind of caught the attention of the National Institute of Justice, who quickly determined that Kevlar body armor could be comfortably worn by American law enforcement officers on a daily basis, and it would save lives. And now I can remember seeing some older stuff when they were first introducing Kevlar body armor. There was a salesman that would actually shoot himself in the chest, you know, hold the gun out and shoot him. Wouldn't have anybody else shoot him, but he would hold a revolver out and shoot himself in the chest with Kevlar. You know, they say it's bulletproof, right? And it is. It will save your life. But from what I understand, I've never been shot. It's like, you know, having Mike Tyson punch you in the chest. So it's going to leave a bruise and it's going to hurt really, really bad, but you're going to live. So you mentioned about body armor and, you know, how we issue body armor to every one of our officers. And I think the majority, a lot of the country does that. I know there are some departments that may or may not. But body armor costs about the stuff we issue is a level three. It's about $900 to $1,000. And for the most of the time you've seen officers wear body armor under their uniforms. But now you're starting to see a lot more, stuff like this, outer vest carriers. And that's what our officers carry. And, you know, some people think it maybe looks a little tactical or something like that, but the reason we do that sort of stuff is to try to get some of the equipment off of our belt. It's to disperse all that equipment that we wear on our belt. So body armor weighs about, you know, 15 pounds or so, actually probably a little less than that. But with all the other equipment that you're wearing around your belt, it's about 20 pounds or so, and that can cause a lot of problems with your hips. So we wear ours as external body armor, but then other departments might wear it under their shirt. But it is mandatory that our officers, every time they're in uniform, have to have body armor on. So,
yeah, I offered to, in order to help raise funds, to get shot wearing a vest. NextStar corporate wouldn't allow that, and there were too many people lining up to take that shot. So we couldn't but I offered. Because I'm a man of the people, so I'll start with Lou. Your father was a police officer, right? So I would assume back then he didn't have a bulletproof vest. What was it like for the transition of the department as he came up when vests were introduced?
Yeah, I mean it's a good point. I think a vest wouldn't help my father, unfortunately, because he was ultimately shot in the head, and then he wasn't on. He had to retire after that, so he wasn't on the department when they started becoming more prevalent. So he worked the street like many officers before him, and throughout our history with no vest whatsoever. Now it feels uncomfortable, believe it or not, to go out without one. I'm telling you, it's just, you're just so used to it. Now, comfortable is a relevant term. So to, you know, Louise, who our friend who created this, comfortable is a relative term, and they've gotten more comfortable for sure. But let's be honest, something that's going to stop a bullet and has the tensile strength of steel is not going to be very breathable. So, you know, they're hot. I mean, they're hot. So for our friends in law enforcement in the South and Southwest, I mean, they are hot. But the trade-off is one that you just don't want to make. You've got to wear it, and you just get used to wearing it. There have been crazy inventions. I never have had one, but I've seen officers try some unique things, like taking a hose from their air conditioner in a squad car and putting it in the vest to blow the cool air in.
Paul Riggio, right, maybe?
Yeah.
We had it's Paul Riggio.
Vestulator. That's what we called it, the vestulator. He tried so.
Yeah. So there's definitely always been attempts, but at the end of the day, it is what it is. It's designed to stop a projectile from penetrating your chest, and it's going to be hot. And I just find it, you know, I always found it whenever we would chase somebody in a foot pursuit, not whenever, but oftentimes you chase somebody in foot pursuit and they'd laugh because either some of their friends got away or whatever. And we're like, listen, we're wearing a vest that, you know, first of all, we're middle-aged people chasing 19-year-old kids. You're in gym shoes and shorts. We're wearing a vest with 20 pounds on it and the additional equipment. I mean, it isn't designed for success to be fleet of foot. It just isn't, you know. But again, the trade-off of not wearing it, I wouldn't trade off. You've got to wear it, and you've just got to you've got to keep in mind that what it's there to do, and it has, to the point of Chief Bergelman, it has saved so many lives. I mean, so many lives have been saved. We just had one. I think it was it Old County that just had that shooting?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And one of the officers was shot in the vest.
Yeah.
He's here today. So had this not been created, there are definitely people that would not be walking the earth right now. And for our law enforcement officers, you know, it is an incredible piece of equipment. So again, back to the debate, is the radio more important? Is the body armor more important? Well, it depends on the incident, depends on the day. I mean, if you've got a mass shooting like we did, that radio really came in handy because we were able to coordinate. But if you're an officer who was just shot with the vest, I would say that's probably the most important piece of equipment you've ever owned. So it is relevant. But body armor has certainly evolved. They are talking about, and I was looking at it earlier. They're talking about it is still in the process of becoming thinner and better. So we're all hopeful. I don't know if any of us will see it in our career, but who knows? Maybe in the future it'll be a T-shirt that, you know, somebody can throw on. You do see these, John Wick has a jacket that protects him. I would say that's probably not real. I've not seen one. dare to dream, though. Dare to dream. Hopefully that does happen sometime soon for the officers. Makes it more comfortable.
Dave and Mimi, you want to share any stories of either that you had with your police, with your bulletproof vest or a colleague that helped them?
Yeah, well, so, you know, speaking. Obviously they're not the most comfortable, but I'm with Lou. Like when I first caught on and I was in patrol my whole career, I'm going to say never, because I never did. I never wore my uniform without my vest. I was the one that would wear my vest under my dress blouse. Like, I just always believe that at any point in time, you could be caught up somewhere, whether you're traveling to and from to Springfield or whatnot, you stop to assist somebody, that you should always just, I always wore my vest. It just, it didn't feel right if I didn't have it on. So no matter how hot it was, you know, state fairs, when it would get 100 degrees, like, it didn't matter. You always wore your vest. But I do recall one of our troopers early on in my career, getting shot, a guy that I, you know, was in the academy with that got shot in the vest. And again, he's lucky to be here. He got shot twice, and he's lucky to be here. Just like Lou said, like, the vest has saved so many police officers' lives. So it's a great thing to have. And I think the shelf life on them is like every 4 to 5 years, 5 years. Yeah. I remember getting a new vest. Yeah. So 5 years, you know, you got to replace. I think that's great too, that we're reissuing vests and you have to have a new vest every 5 years. So fully support that though.
And what I learned was, you know, it's like you said, you're wearing it in 32 below, you're wearing it in 100 degrees in humidity or 95 with the humidity like today. You know, so it breaks down, and different weather conditions, you're in and out of cars, and the material degrades. And to keep the police officer safe, at least I had a vest representative on the show talking about it. They say every 5 years with technology and the upgrade and the material and safety that they just cycle them out every 5 years. Dave, before we head over to tasers, which you're going to be talking about, do you have any story about body armor that helped you?
Yeah, Dave, you know, I was going to, you know, we had a, I remember this, one of the troopers, I was a sergeant, but I handled a pretty bad crash. One of the troopers had crashed, but the trauma plate in back in early on, they had steel trauma plates. So they go over your heart. They were made of steel, and this actually saved him in a crash because the impact on his chest from the steering wheel, I mean, the steering wheel almost bent around his chest. But that trauma plate probably saved him from that impact to his heart. So it's not always bullets that vest can save you from some substantial injuries, especially in crashes. So now they moved away from the steel trauma plates. They have the more of a softer trauma plate now. But at the end of the day, that steel trauma plate saved him. And like everyone said, of course, I wear mine. I got it on now. I've always put mine on. Anytime I'm in uniform, just like Mimi said, I used to, when I first came on, ISP did not mandate that you wear your vest. So I had some of the old guard, they wouldn't wear it. And one guy, he told me, he's like, look, man, if it's my time, it's my time. I ain't wearing no vest. And I was like, wow, okay. So, but as a young rookie, I mean, you know, I did, you know, I followed protocol and I felt like, you know, the academy said, wear your vest, I'm wearing my vest. And I also felt, you know, hey, well, you know, God might be also telling if you wear your vest, I'm gonna save you that day. So it depends on how you look at it. Some officers, you know, who came on in the 70s and in the 60s, you know, or whenever, you know, when vests first started coming around, they chose not to wear them. And that was their own personal choice. But then, of course, at some point, after I came on in the early 90s, they started mandating that you would wear it when you came to work. So that was a good thing. So,
all right, well, take us now, transition us into tasers. That'll be the last topic of the show. I'll tell you what, real quick, sure. Kirk, why don't you do that promotion of that event so we don't get.
Yeah, perfect. So for the thousands of officers out there watching our podcast today, the Midwest Security and Police Conference and Expo, being sponsored by Illinois Chiefs of Police, is August 22nd and 23rd in Tinley Park, Illinois. So all of the technology, most of the technology that we're not even talking about today, body-worn cameras, digital evidence management, biometrics, forensics, non-lethal weapons, cybercrime tools, drones. There will be vendors at this conference for all of that. So tons of vendors, tons of new technology. So if you are looking to purchase some things or would like to come to this, reach out to Illinois Chiefs, ilchiefs.org, and come over to the Midwest Security and Police Conference and Expo. August 22nd, 23rd.
He's got a future. He's got a future in radio. Maybe have him do your tagline for Team Hopper. I mean, he's got
you should know it by now. If anybody here, let's practice. If anybody's looking to purchase or refinance, call Team Hochberg, sponsor of the show. I teed it up for you. There you go. So Dave, let's talk about tasers, buddy.
Yeah. So before I jump into that, I want to just add a couple other just to show you some quick evolution of equipment, though. So you want an evolution of the handcuff? I mean, if you look at this compared to this, I mean, you know, so that's one evolution. If you, the gas mask, look how this evolved. Now this is an old school gas mask. I mean, of course, all that has evolved and gotten a whole lot better. So, but this is what they used to wear probably in the 70s and beyond. And then I did want to talk about, we talked about emergency equipment. His old fireball. I know you guys probably recognize these. These are all magnetized. So, Dave, these type of emergency lights would go in the interior of the squad and to the rear. I had a pretty bad crash. I got rear-ended. You know, I talked about this with my mom when she was on the phone, on the show with us. But, and this came off and hit me in the back of the head, you know, got me pretty good from the crash. So these things but this is what we use for emergency lights. Now they got strobes and all kind of LED lights and all this kind of stuff, which is amazing. And then the last thing I will show is that I had to show this evolution because it's pretty funny as well. I don't have my flashlight with me, but it's in the car. But this was the flashlight. Now this, I mean, this is probably a D cell battery, and this is what you had. So now we have rechargeables and these guys have lapel lights and all types of things now. So just some nostalgia just for, everyone who's watching. This is an old police officer's flashlight. So even before the mag light, which came out shortly after that. So just interesting stuff to have. I'm glad we have a lot of this stuff still here at DPD. We could probably make, we got our own little museum of nostalgic equipment that we keep. So that's actually pretty cool stuff. So jumping into Taser. Taser, which is a conducted energy device, CED, primarily used to incapacitate people, allowing them to be approached and handled in an arresting situation and also a less than lethal manner. The Taser was developed in the U.S. by a NASA researcher, named Jack Culver, who started work on the device in 1969. Producing a working model 5 years later in 1974. Jack Culver's childhood hero was a fictional inventor named Tom Swift, so he named his invention after his book, Tom Swift and His Electric Rifle, or Taser for short.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. Arts are connected to the main unit by a thin lacquer, insulated copper wire, and deliver a modulated electric current designed to disrupt voluntary control of muscles. So that's what Taser is supposed to do, causing neuromuscular incapacitation. Now, that sounds pretty. Now, that's a term. The effects of a Taser may only be localized pain or strong involuntary long muscle contractions based on the mode of use and connectivity of the darts. So the darts are projectiles that come out of the Taser, which in most cases will incapacitate a violent resistor or active resistor, is what we call them. So it doesn't work on everybody. That's one of the things that we have learned through our trials and errors with law enforcement that, I've seen people get tased and they pull the darts out, and they're ready to still, they're ready to fight. So, but I will say this, that I've never had opportunity to actually have a Taser, but for everybody who it has, I can tell you that they will say it was an unbelievable, impactful tool, especially as a less, opportunity, which is all these type, this type of devices, a less than lethal a way of, gaining compliance of an active resistor. So, I mean, I think in my eyes, as far as technology, Taser is probably one of the biggest impactful or most impactful uses of technology that we've had in law enforcement in a pretty good while. It takes the place of, in my eyes, I mean, would you rather, using a baton? We know what the use of a baton can look like, even when it's legally done. And when you look at Rodney King, of course, that was not a legal example of how to use a baton and take someone into custody. Believe me, that was definitely not the example you would want to use. But there were times when the use of a baton was justified and necessary to take someone into custody, but it still looked horrible. you know, because just of the use, just the mechanism itself. So I would rather use a taser, in my opinion, because I believe it's, you know, it's probably, you know, more effective. And, it, you know, you can get the subject in custody and in compliance a lot faster by using the taser. So at the end of the day, you have to be extremely careful with that. That's why the way the taser is positioned on your body, we keep it away from our firearm because we don't want to have a situation. And that has happened in the past where, you know, an officer could get confused in the heat of a moment. Instead of taking his taser and drawing his taser, he would or he or she could accidentally draw his firearm. We changed the color on the taser. So that as another reminder, this is the taser. It's not your firearm. And in the heat of the moment, I mean, you know, your mind is working and a lot of things are coming at you, Dave, and you know, you don't want to make mistakes. So, you know, Taser's done a great job. All the manufacturers who actually make Tasers have done an amazing job of making sure that the separation between how a firearm would feel or look is different from how a Taser would feel or look. And I think that's extremely important.
Well, it just happened recently. I think less than a year ago, there was that officer, female officer up in Minnesota that was charged. She admitted that, you know, it wasn't intentional. And unfortunately, you know, there was a loss of a life. And she, I think she got put in jail for it. It was horrible for everybody involved. So, Mimi, what was your experience with tasers when you were on the force?
So, yeah, so I myself, like Dave, when we got tasers, I was a command officer, so I didn't use one. I supervised those that did, and so I can't speak to actually, you know, using it on anyone. But I do think, along with what Dave said, that it definitely is, you know, when it comes to use of force, I feel that the taser is good because you're not right on top of somebody. It actually is separating you, whether they're running from you or whether you need compliance. You're able to maintain that distance between you and that person, which, you know, we always talk about creating that distance between the offender and yourself so that you have, you know, that split second time to get what you need. So I do think the taser definitely comes in handy. I mean, you know, it, you know, no one on the job ever wants to use lethal force and deadly force. And if it's a means to be able to use something else besides that, then that's what the officers choose, you know, will do. Now there's times where you can't, you have to do what you have to do. You know, we always say to make it home each night to keep yourself and your fellow officers in the community safe. So, I think the taser was a big thing that came out in policing. That's probably one of the biggest strides that we made in policing.
Kirk, yeah. How many times? I'm sorry, Dave. Go.
No, I'm just going to say also, just to piggyback, is that, you know, the specifications of and the responsibility of the taser and the user manual. I mean, it's really important that you know when you can use taser, where you can tase, you know, there's strict requirements in regard to that, because there's certain areas you cannot tase someone. I mean, and you know, you want to be careful with that. So like Mimi said, a lot of times when people are running, I mean, of course, it would be very impactful, but you just gotta be mindful. There are people with pacemakers that you get into some situation, people with pre-existing conditions where the use of a taser against them may or may not, you know, turn into a life-threatening situation. This depends. So we have to be mindful of that. Every officer is taught and trained how to use the taser. And of course, just like all our training, I mean, recertifications are required on a yearly basis. And, you know, and those are the type of things that that we have to continue to do, is continue to train our officers correctly so we can use the tasers appropriately. So,
got it. Kirk, how many times have your officers discharged a taser within the past year? Do you keep track of that?
Yes, we do. I don't know off the top of my head. I would say we probably discharge our tasers about half a dozen times a year. We pull them and point them probably 3 to 4 times as much. The tasers are very interesting because they have a little laser that goes on them. And as tasers have evolved, or as they've been more prevalent in law enforcement, people know what that little laser means. And it means a lot of pain, and it does hurt. But it's temporary pain. The interesting thing, you know, Hollywood gets so many things right. And the one thing that they don't really get right is the tasers and the stun guns. It's kind of important to know that when you watch a movie and somebody gets tasered or stun gunned, they immediately like pass out and they're out for, you know, 5 minutes, or they wet themselves or whatever. It doesn't really happen that way. The taser only works while it's being activated for about 5 seconds, unless you activate it again. And once that's over, you can kind of stand up. Probably one of the best examples of a taser use was just recently. I don't know if people have seen it, the Reds fan that ran onto the field a couple weeks ago and was tased by the officer. You know, whether or not you think that's right or wrong, it's a good example of what the taser can be used for in situations, in that it incapacitated him. He went down to the ground, and then the officer was able to then effectively make an arrest without fighting him, without getting hurt.
So running around, looking like a knucklehead, yep.
Exactly. Puts him on the ground. The officer can come over. They can handcuff them, take control, and then that's over. There's no fighting or anything like that. So that's the big thing that we try to stress to our officers, is that's a method that we can use so that way the suspect doesn't get hurt and our officers don't get hurt. So,
I mean, it was pretty impressive. It was a pretty impressive backflip, then drop like an absolute sack of potatoes. So
it was, he did a good job of that backflip.
It was really good. Lou, how many times a year do your officers have to pull out their tasers up in Highland Park and use it? Is it, you know, on a daily basis? Is it sporadic? You know, what are your totals?
Yeah, definitely not on a daily basis. I'd say along the same line as Kirk's. But it definitely is a good deterrent. You know, you show that those laser beams, and you can even, it's called arc testing. You can even let the sparks go a little bit to get somebody's attention. And let me tell you, it gets their attention. So it is a useful tool. I will say, and I know we're up against the clock, so I'll be quick. I will say, you know, much like the body armor was, you know, pivotal for law enforcement safety, the tasers are really pivotal for our community safety and for people who, you know, are fighting or going to be doing something worse. I mean, there are people alive today because the taser is here and we didn't have to use lethal force or, you know, up the level of force. Couple of things, you know, tasers, you know, they are painful, but our officers go through training and that includes being tased. So when our new officers here in Highland Park get hired, we make a journey into our training room. Everybody comes and watches because they remember how it felt. And they, you know, get tased in the back with the prongs and the taser too, so they can experience and know what it feels like. So we're not just using this and inflicting this on people without knowing what it feels like. We endure it and subject ourselves to it too. We feel that that's the right thing to do, and also to have an understanding of how it works. So it's always an interesting part of the training. I don't know too many professions that subject themselves to something like that as part of their training, but we do. And then we did have, just not too long ago, a really good success story. A gentleman kind of took over an intersection here at rush hour and was, you know, really wanting the police to shoot him. I mean, that's what he was saying. Shoot me, I've got a gun. Shoot me, kill me. And he kept putting his hand in his waistband and he kept reaching for things. We couldn't see a gun. We had officers there with cover. And you know, ultimately somebody got into a decent position behind him and was able to tase him and take him down. And there was no gun. But, you know, it looked like he was trying to maybe affect a suicide by cop. And how horrible would that have been if he made some sort of sudden movement and our officer shot that person and he didn't have a firearm? Horrible for everybody. It happens across the country. So in that particular instance, you know, he lives to fight another day. Our officers didn't have to endure that or, you know, live through themselves a traumatic incident of shooting somebody who wasn't armed. He was obviously having, you know, some sort of an issue in his life. But it worked. He's here today, no doubt about it, because of Taser. And so as much as the body armor is helping officers, I think Tasers are helping our community, and they're good tools. They hurt, but they affect an arrest, and they do it in a much less, clearly less lethal way than other options.
Better to have a bruise than be dead.
Yeah, for sure.
And just to just one quick comment. Just in hearing everyone talk, it's pretty amazing. Like police officers, you know, why they're so brave and courageous. They have to make these split minute decisions on what the appropriate course of action is. Like it's just in using a taser, you know, you're literally watching somebody and you're trying to figure out how am I going to get this person in custody? What do I need to do next? But it's going 1,000 miles a minute that you're trying to figure out what is your best solution, your best decision. And there's no other profession like that. We can't have a sidebar and say, okay, this is what we have. You know, everyone pause for a second. Let me try to figure out what I'm going to do next. The profession itself is so noble because we're trained. Our training kicks in. Everything is about training. Your training just kicks in. And that's why training with tasers and any part of being a police officer is so important. But I just want to push that out there that, you know, when it comes to tasers and using it, these police officers are analyzing, you know, by the millisecond on what they need to do to, you know, keep everyone safe, to handle the situation and have a successful outcome. So I just have to say that.
Yeah, I concur. No timeouts. There are no timeouts. So.
No. So, I mean, we covered a lot, right? We covered radios. We covered police vests. We covered tasing. I'm missing one. Which one? What else do we?
Radar.
Lou's topic. Radar. So I wonder why I forgot that. So we.
Who to call for your home mortgage needs? 855-56 David, Team Hochberg.
Oh, there he goes.
Very well done. All your refinance. What's that mean?
There's your co-host.
Oh, I'm feeling threatened here. You know, I might be obsolete here in a couple of shows here. But well done, Kirk. Yeah, if you're looking to purchase a new home or refinance your existing home, give me a call. The guy's sponsoring this fine podcast. And we appreciate everybody listening. Behind the Badge, Illinois. We'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for joining us, Chiefs. Have a great weekend, guys.